Hi, and welcome to the Microsoft Virtual Academy. I'm Simon Perryman, Senior Technical Evangelist, and I'm joined by Jeff Woolsey, a Principal Program Manager. And today, we're going to answer all of your questions live on the show. Now, what we're going to really focus on is all types of Microsoft virtualization based on our previous Jumpstart. But let's quickly introduce ourselves. Now, as I said, I'm Simon Perryman. I do a lot of these Jumpstarts, and that's my role as a technical evangelist, really to help educate you guys about all of our different Microsoft technologies. Prior to this role, I spent about 4 years actually as an engineer building a lot of these products on the cluster team, and that's actually how I first ran into Jeff. So, Jeff, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Simon. I'm Jeff Woolsey. I'm a Principal Program Manager in the Windows Server and Cloud Division. I'm focused on virtualization. I'm focused on cloud. I had the pleasure of working on virtualization now for over 15 years, 10 of it here at Microsoft, whether it's been Hyper-V, whether it's been Virtual Server, been working on virtualization for a very long time. Way back when, in fact, people wanted to run DOS and Windows 3.1 on their Apple Power Mac 6100, 7100, and 8100. So honestly, I've been doing virtualization as well as binary translation a long time, and it's really awesome to see how the technology has matured so much and how we're moving to a different paradigm now. It's not just virtualization. It's not just consolidation. It is about moving to cloud.
So actually, why don't we jump to our first question? What is Microsoft's cloud vision
yes.
we have?
Yeah, no, you know, this is something we get asked all the time. And I finally, you know, I want to make sure I wanted to start today's conversation about what our cloud OS vision is. This isn't a secret. This is actually, we've been pretty clear about this, but there's still a lot of confusion as to what we mean by our cloud OS vision. So let me be very transparent about this. We think of the cloud as really, you know, having three equal legs of a stool. All right, so if we take our cloud, divide it up into three portions, what do we see? Well, let's start with where cloud has really started. Cloud has really started with the private cloud. And private cloud has really been an outgrowth of virtualization. So let me explain what I mean by that. Back in the 90s, it seemed like the problem that everybody had could always be solved by, hey, let's just go buy another server. Servers were inexpensive, they were easy to set up, hey, I need another web server, I need a file on the server, another print server, let's go buy them and let's start setting them up. And so in the 90s, we were buying servers as fast as we could, we had plenty of budget, we had all the time, we had IT resources, everything was good. And in fact, that continued into to the aught decade, and in fact, we had people doing the same thing, we continued to buy servers at a very fast clip, except things started to change. The conversation started to change. People would come to Microsoft and come talk to us and say, you know, I still have the budget to buy as many servers as I need, but the problem is I have no place to put them and no power to power them with. So what really happened was, while they could still buy all the physical servers, the ability to manage them, the ability to house them, the power became a real problem. In fact, I talked to people in East Coast, you know, Chicago high-rises, New York high-rises that said, Jeff, we need to request an upgrade on the grid. That's the type of power problems that we're running into. And so, you know, we realized that this was a major problem, and virtualization grew as an outgrowth to solve that for consolidation. So, for example, you had 5, you had 10, you had 20 servers, and you virtualized them and you ran them on a single physical server. And that's great. That's virtualization for consolidation. That's not cloud. In fact, what happened was when we did this virtualization and this consolidation, we basically, we took, you know, a bunch of physical machines, maybe we did a physical to virtual conversion and put them in VMs, but the management paradigm never changed. What I mean by that is you still went to a VM, just like you went to a physical machine, you log in and you make changes on each individual server, whether it was a physical machine or a virtual machine. You allocated resources. Well, you gave a VM this amount of memory or this amount of storage or this amount of networking, that never changed. So while we moved to virtualization for consolidation, which is a fine thing, it's a very good thing, that's not cloud. When we think about cloud, cloud is about being able to define resources, define an application, define policy, and say, look, here's an application that may start off as, you know what, it needs a couple of virtual processors, maybe it needs a couple gigabytes of memory, but I want it to be elastic. I want it to be able to grow. And this type of cloud model needs to begin at development when you're thinking about how are we going to develop the application in the first place. I want to develop a rich scale-out application that can take advantage of the elasticity that the cloud can give me. Of course, I need end-to-end management. One of the biggest problems I've seen for the last 10 years is people go to virtualization and they think, wow, everything's going to be magically good because once I move into a VM, you know, things will automatically just take care of themselves, which could not be more wrong. could not be more wrong. Just because I took a workload, move it from a physical machine into a virtual machine, doesn't mean all of a sudden that all of the problems that I had in the past just go away. You still need to patch manage it, you still need to monitor your application, you need to monitor the health and the life cycle and the support life cycle of the application. So management is critical and key. And of course, being able to have identity that permeates all of these different areas and basically single sign-on and give me the ability to actually move these workloads to different locations, locales, and my identity to go with me is a key part of this. So it all started with the private cloud, and the private cloud is about control. Okay, that's really the easiest way to describe it. I've talked with customers all over the world, Brazil, Australia, Canada, Europe, and very often someone will say, you know what, Jeff, I have a workload that has to run in a Canadian data center on Canadian soil by a Canadian citizen. So no matter how cool a service provider is or the Microsoft public cloud offerings are, there's a bunch of workloads that I'm always going to run on my premises. So don't try and argue with me. And you know what? I'm not going to try and argue with me. Let's build you the best private cloud together. And for that, that means Windows Server and System Center. That's how we think, you know, that's how we deliver those pieces of the puzzle to you. At the same time, we also understand that, you know what? There's plenty of workloads that can move elsewhere. So for example, the second part of this is how we think about the public cloud. And for example, let's start with mail, a really simple one. How many companies, how many corporations really need to run their own Exchange server? Now, maybe you're a law firm and you need it for attorney-client privilege. Okay, that may make sense. But for a lot of companies, mail is just a service they consume that, honestly, they may not need to actually own and run their own Exchange server. So why not run it in Office 365? So we've got software as a service with Office 365. We have Windows Azure, which provides us platform as a service. So if you want to build a brand new application today that literally can span and scale the entire globe, you can do it today, right now, on Windows Azure. You can use your MSDN account. You can create a new application right here. Hey, I can create it here in North America, develop it and test it. And guess what? When it runs, let's go ahead and make this available in South America or in Asia Pacific or in Europe. And it's basically just publishing to different regions and letting Azure do all the work for you. With platform as a service, you focus on the application. You're focused on the experience you're trying to deliver to your end user. And you're not focused on, well, how do I develop high availability? How do I deliver clustering? How do I deliver, you know, all of these, the infrastructure itself? We deliver that for you. So public cloud is about scale. Finally, the last piece of the puzzle are service providers. Because we understand that, you know what? You probably have a good relationship with service providers. You may have this already, and you want to be able to provide. You already have customization. You already have reach from service providers, and you may have contracts and relationship in place. Great. We understand that you want to be able to take your workloads that start in the private cloud, and maybe you want to move them to a service provider. Maybe you want to move them to Azure. But you know what? That flexibility should be left up to you. That's based on your business needs. So when we think about the cloud OS and our vision of what the cloud OS looks like, the reason why I'm telling you this is because if you talk to some of our competitors, someone will say, no, cloud, it's running VMs on your site. That's cloud. Others will tell you, no, cloud is running, you know, some VMs up on some public site. Others will tell you, no, cloud is running my consumed service from a service provider. We look at cloud as, no, it's all of these things. It's public, it's service, it's private cloud. That's how we think about the cloud very holistically. And that's kind of, you know, kind of our mission. That's our North Star. That's how we're delivering on our cloud. And that's our cloud OS vision.
Great. Well, that was an excellent explanation. But now if we could switch back to our deck, we're going to focus on your questions. So please,
absolutely,
don't hesitate to ask these questions. We have a great chat room and we have dozens of experts that are lined up to help you. But, you know, first of all, ask us anything. While the focus of this session really is on Hyper-V virtualization, you know, we have a great team of experts. You can ask us about Windows Server, other types of virtualization, so please get those questions out. However, we will primarily focus on Hyper-V. failover clustering, and System Center Virtual Machine Manager. Now, we also will touch on any other type of different System Center components you have. So if you want to think about how can I back up a VM, how can I automate my deployment, how can I offer self-service, how can I offer service to different end users and let them consume that, we will be able to answer all those questions. We have a full demo environment, so ask whatever you want. We're going to take some of these questions live. Some of our experts are going to answer your questions, but our goal is to answer anything you want to know about Microsoft Virtualization. Now, there's also a lot of content available that maps back to this training on the Microsoft Virtual Academy. A couple of weeks ago, Jeff and I actually ran a full day of training, Introduction to Hyper-V Jumpstart, and we got dozens and dozens. Actually, I lie. We got hundreds and hundreds of questions about that. Literally, a massive chat log. And so we saw value in actually running a session and allowing you guys to ask those questions live. So if you want to refer back to some great training material, check out the Microsoft Virtual Academy. And don't forget to join the Microsoft Virtual Academy community. We now have over 1 million members, and you can actually get 50 free bonus points today if you go to aka.ms/MVAVoucher. So sign up today, get those points. Now let's really focus on the Q&A. Mm-hmm. First thing, here's the topics that we covered during our last event. Started kind of talking generally about Microsoft Virtualization, then really focused on the Hyper-V infrastructure, the storage, the networking, management of Hyper-Vs. Then we kind of took it a step further and scaled out beyond managing a single server to managing multiple servers by introducing clustering and live migration. We then took it a step further with our broad data center management, looking at how Virtual Machine Manager gives us the ability to monitor and operate multiple hosts, multiple clusters at scale. And finally, we tied Hyper-V back to our other System Center components. So get asking those questions. Our team's ready to help you out. Now with that, first question that I actually see already on our list here is probably a good one for you. Real quickly, what's new in Hyper-V 2012? It's kind of a broad question and we have a lot of great resources, but give us kind of the 2-minute overview of what's new.
Yeah, you know, that really is a very broad question, and in 2 minutes I'll give you a quick flyby pass over some of the major changes that have happened in Hyper-V. Of course, we have to start with scale. When it comes to Hyper-V scale, we pretty much redefined what scale and performance look like in Hyper-V. For example, on the physical side now, we support the largest physical servers in the industry with up to 320 logical processors per server and up to 4 terabytes of memory per server. Just to give you an idea how big a machine that is, 320 logical processors is a 16-socket server. Each socket has 10 cores, and then you enable symmetric multithreading. So it's a very, very big machine. On top of that, in the virtual machine scale, we now support virtual machines with up to 64 virtual processors per VM. And so that's, I also want to point out, that's available in Windows Server 2012 Standard. That's available in Windows Server 2012 Data Center. It's also available in our free standalone product, Microsoft Hyper-V Server. So let me be very clear. This isn't something where you have to go buy the top-end thing to get the top-end feature. We don't look at it that way. We want to give you the best platform for cloud. So with Hyper-V, it's all in there. So even our free product offers up to 64 virtual processors per VM. In addition to that, we support up to 1 terabyte of memory per VM. So again, from a scale perspective, we give you huge amounts in terms of compute and memory. In terms of storage, we have a new virtual disk format. In addition to VHD, which we support and continue to support, we have the new VHDX format. And one of the big advancements in the VHDX format is we support up to 64 terabytes per virtual disk. Not per VM, per virtual disk. And you can have literally hundreds of virtual disks per virtual machine. So if you actually do the math, we support upwards of 16 petabytes of storage per virtual machine. So you're going to run out of physical storage long before you run out of virtual storage. So on the scale side, that's a huge one. On the automation side, we've done a major huge investment in PowerShell. Hyper-V now has a full native PowerShell implementation in Windows Server 2012 with over 150 PowerShell commandlets. So anything you can do in the UI, and in fact more, can even be done through PowerShell, whether it's creating VMs, creating disks, configuring networking, configuring storage, etc., etc., etc. From an automation standpoint, PowerShell is a first-class citizen with Hyper-V. From a VM mobility standpoint, I know we're going to talk about this quite a bit today, but one of the biggest changes is pretty much every part of a VM can now be live migrated, you name it. You want to live migrate your VM's compute, you want to live migrate migrate storage. You actually want to do a share nothing live migration, where you can literally live migrate a virtual machine between two servers with nothing but network connectivity. So now you don't even need shared storage. So we have completely uncorked all of any and all restrictions that we used to have on mobility. And in fact, we were the first to offer shared nothing live migration in the industry. From the networking standpoint, we made a huge, huge investment in networking, and we're going to talk quite a bit about this today. But the first of all, the built-in virtual switch itself has taken a huge step forward. We have a whole bunch of new capabilities in there for security, in there for quality of service and service level agreements, as well as some new advancements that take advantage of latest hardware advancements in network adapters themselves. So we'll talk about that. And then finally, of course, the switch itself is an extensible switch now. So you can actually plug into the switch. So for example, if you'd like to use something like the Cisco Nexus 1000V, or if you're an OpenFlow shop, NEC has an OpenFlow switch ready available right now. In fact, it was first developed for Hyper-V. It's ready to go right now. And in fact, it's part of a much larger software-defined networking story that we'll be talking about today. So again, that's just a quick flyover. There's plenty more we'll get to in later today, but those are just a few of the things there.
Great. Well, we actually have a few questions coming in. Now you mentioned that there was a free version. I'm assuming you mean the Hyper-V server. What exactly is the Hyper-V server? Yes. How do people get it?
So I'll be honest with you. A lot of people ask me, I heard the rumor that there's some free version of Hyper-V, and I'm sorry that it seems to be a kind of a rumor. There's nothing rumor about it. It's real. It's very real. The problem is when it's a free product, it's hard to get marketing get really excited about marketing a free product, and so I'm going to be a little transparent about there. Microsoft Hyper-V Server is kind of my baby, and I've always I've been very proud of this product, and this is actually our fourth release of Hyper-V Server. Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012. Let me be crystal clear. Let me talk directly into the camera, because not a lot of people believe me when I say it. It is 100% free. It is a completely free download. You download the ISO file. It is a full DVD install. Burn the DVD, put it in your machine, and it literally installs on the metal. Okay? You don't need Windows Server. The first bit of FUD I always hear is, no, you have to buy Windows Server to get it. No, you don't. Microsoft Hyper-V Server is a free standalone. It's just the hypervisor. Let me be very clear. Okay? It's Windows Server comes with all of these roles and capabilities. It comes with Active Directory. It comes with IIS. It comes with file and print and ADFS and all of these different roles that make up Windows Server. Microsoft Hyper-V Server is literally just the hypervisor. Okay? And we did this because we know there are a lot of places where people simply just want, I just want the hypervisor bits. For example, IIS, I don't need print, I don't need anything, I just want the hypervisor. And it is truly full-featured and it's rich. It's got, like I mentioned before, 64 virtual processors. It supports up to 320 logical processors, just like full-on Windows Server. It comes with clustering. There's a lot of people out there that been thinking for many years, oh no, it doesn't come with live migration or clustering. No, that's the other guys. We didn't create a dumbed down version of our hypervisor. This is the real full hypervisor. This comes with live migration. It comes with shared nothing live migration. It comes with Team Nix. It comes with our disaster recovery capabilities, Hyper-V Replica. This is all in the free hypervisor, Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012. And secretly, I know that a bunch of you know about this because I've been seeing, as I watch the download numbers, over 20,000 downloads a month for Microsoft Hyper-V Server. So while I admit that we don't really market it and you don't hear much talk about it, clearly some people out there know about it because I've been watching the download numbers and we're seeing a crazy amount of people downloading the free hypervisor Microsoft Hyper-V Server. From a management standpoint, to be very clear, so Hyper-V Server, you install on the metal, but you actually don't create any VMs or run anything locally. All the VMs, there's no local GUI, I should say. All the VMs run on the server, but all the management happens remotely, and that's the goal. The goal is you set up a Hyper-V Server and then you manage it from another machine. That other machine could be running Windows 8 with our free remote server administration toolkit or RSAT. That's a free download. You could also run it from a full Windows Server 2012 install using Hyper-V Manager and Failover Clustering Manager, etc. Or you could be managing it remotely with System Center Virtual Machine Manager and our System Center technology. So There's a bunch of different ways you can manage it. Nothing is required. You don't have to use System Center. If you want to do live migration, you can use it using all the free tools. It's really up to you. So that's a quick primer on Hyper-V Server 2012.
Great, and I think you kind of alluded to one of the key things, you know, full support of clustering, cluster shared volumes, live migration,
yes.
64 nodes, 8,000 VMs a cluster.
Yes. Actually, I mention one more thing. People ask me why we have this product. I should mention why this product exists. There's actually two really awesome scenarios for Hyper-V Server. Let me tell you both of them. Number one, I know this is going to shock everyone, Linux. So here's the thing. You buy Windows Server 2012 Data Center Edition. Well, why do you buy Data Center Edition? You buy Data Center Edition because I'm going to license this for this server, and I get unlimited copies of Windows Server. So people buy Windows Server Data Center, they install Hyper-V, they run all their copies of Windows, they're pleased as punch. But I got a little bit of Linux over here. I got some Red Hat or some CentOS or some SUSE or some Debian or some Ubuntu or something over here, and I'd like to run that on Hyper-V. You can absolutely run that on Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V, no problems. In fact, we've done a whole bunch of work integrating our integration services right into the Linux kernel. However, a bunch of people say, look, Jeff, I bought Data Center because I want all of these, I want to take advantage of the unlimited licensing. So if I put Linux on a Windows server, it uses one of those little licensing slots. So what I really want to do is I want to run Linux, and in fact, I want to run it on Hyper-V so I can manage all of this with System Center, but I don't want it to use one of these licensing slots. Guess what? Use Microsoft Hyper-V Server. Run it right next to it. You can manage it all with System Center. You get a free hypervisor, and then you can run all of your Linux distros and manage it all systematically with System Center. The other reason why Hyper-V Server is a great solution is for VDI. If you're doing VDI deployments, in the case of VDI, you can certainly use Windows Server 2012. You can use Standard or Data Center. The thing you have to understand is Data Center, it comes with unlimited instances for Windows Server. It doesn't do anything for client, so you still need to purchase the client licenses separately. Well, you could also use Hyper-V Server and allow you to run VDI, and it's a great solution for that because RemoteFX is also part of Hyper-V Server. So those are the two reasons why you'd want to run Hyper-V Server.
Great. I think another distinction worth mentioning, you know, a lot of people say, well, why don't I buy only Hyper-V Server and only run that? Remember, this is just the hypervisor platform. It doesn't come with Active Directory, doesn't come with file services. So you still kind of need that full version for your full infrastructure. This is purely for the Hyper-V host. Mm-hmm. But we've actually got some questions more about, you know, that's great, that's free. How can I build kind of my own free test environment? Now, of course, people could go to downloads.microsoft.com, mm-hmm. actually download the Hyper-V server, but what about for their storage, things like mm-hmm. that?
There's a couple of different solutions that we provide here. Number one, I should point out, again, Hyper-V Server is free, but also don't forget, we have full eval versions of Windows Server 2012 available. You can download the eval versions, you can enable Hyper-V, you can create VMs, and guess what? You know, if and when you deploy the full version, you can take those VMs that you created on the eval version and you can move them right over to the full version. So, you know, all of that work that you do on the eval, if you're doing a proof of concept, for example, you can transfer that right on over to the full version, so that's another good way to do it. From a storage perspective, we're extremely flexible in terms of the storage we offer and the storage that we support. So we can certainly work with any type of, you know, block-based storage, whether it's direct attach, whether it's iSCSI, whether it's fiber channel, etc. You could also use our free iSCSI target that you can download, for example, if you have Server 2008R2 and you just want to plug Hyper-V into some existing Server 2008R2. Of course, if you're using Server 2012, then you could use the iSCSI target that's already built into 2012, or you can take advantage of the SMB capabilities and the fantastic new scale-out file server that we have in Windows Server 2012 as well. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can do, you know, really kick the tires on Hyper-V and take advantage of storage that you already own, or even set up some low-cost storage using the capabilities built in file server.
That's great. And if we could just briefly switch back to my slide deck, you're actually going to see, here's our list of where you can find all the products, Microsoft.com/Hyper-V Server, Microsoft.com/Eval Center, or technet.microsoft.com/Eval Center. And one other thing, there's a lot of other products on there you can evaluate, SQL Server 2012, System Center 2012, all the components. And you can even download what's called kind of the private cloud evaluation, which is a combination of Windows Server 2012 plus System Center 2012 as a single downloadable package. Now, we've kind of passed the kind of initial questions about the setup, but a lot of people are asking, you know, what are my basic upgrade choices from a standalone old version of Hyper-V up to a new version of Hyper-V? How can people move their VMs to our newest platform?
Yes. Well, one of the new things that we made, it, one of the new things that we really changed and greatly improved in Server 2012 was the import process. So in the past, there was the process of exporting VMs and importing VMs, and there was a whole bunch of things you had to do to prep the VM to be exported to take it to import into a new version. In Server 2012, we made it a lot easier. And in fact, so there's a number of ways you could do it. You could, if all of your VMs, for example, are located on some centrally attached storage, you could actually just remap the storage from an old server, turn off the VMs, remap the storage to a new Server 2012 server, and import them. That would be certainly one way to do it. Of course, if you've got simply just direct attached storage on a standalone server, and there's nothing shared between the two, and Server 2008 R2, then you're going to basically need to shut down those VMs, copy them over to the new server. Again, if you have direct attached storage, that's the way you're going to do it, then import them, and then fire them up in the Server 2012. Once you do move a VM over to 2012, we will support all of the old VMs that you had running on Server 2008 R2. The one thing we do recommend is that you upgrade the integration services that are running within the virtual machine. And in case you're wondering, integration services are just drivers. Okay, they're drivers that we run inside the virtual machine, but they're highly optimized drivers. And so we're always tuning those, performing more performance tuning and tweaks, and adding new features. So for example, one of the great new features in Server 2012 is virtual fiber channel. And so this allows us to actually present a virtual fiber channel HBA in the VM for the first time. And because it allows us to do that, gives you a greater amount of flexibility, allows you to actually access your native SAN infrastructure. But you have to have the new integration services installed to be able to do that. But that's pretty much what an import, export, or remove process looks like.
Great. And I just wanted to clarify one thing for our VMware folks out there that may be looking to evaluate Hyper-V. We mentioned the integration services. That'd be equivalent to VM tools. It basically allows our host system to go and interact with our guest operating system, power management, things like that. But now, Jeff, you started to talk about some things around networking. You mentioned the Hyper-V extensible switch earlier. Mm-hmm. You mentioned guest fiber channel. Can you just give us an overview of what's new in, you know, Hyper-V networking in 2012?
Yes. In fact, let me switch on over to my demo machine here, so I can actually walk you through a number of the features that are built right into the virtual machine network settings, because there actually are so many, it's easier to show you.
Oh, major area of investment.
So basically, if you think about the switch in the Hyper-V virtual switch in Server 2008 and 2008 R2, think of it as a very simple, unmanaged switch. Okay, basically in Server 2008 and 2008 R2, it was basically all you had was VLANs, and that was what we used for logical segmentation. And for a large number of folks, that was pretty good. That was actually fine for their needs. But we heard that people were interested in a lot more capabilities, and certainly we could have made this part of our extensibility story and said, look, you can purchase an add-on and give you more capabilities, which is something we did. But at the same time, we also wanted to take the core functionality of the virtual switch itself and provide a lot more rich capabilities in it. So, for example, here you can see, first of all, you can see when I go into a virtual machine settings, we used to just have one network adapter setting here in 2008 and 2008 R2. We now actually have pop it open to see that there are a number of both hardware acceleration and advanced features. So here on the first settings, you can see we have bandwidth management. And bandwidth management is something that's been really warmly received by especially our enterprises and our cloud service provider partners, because you need to provide a quality of service to meet a service level agreement. So for example, you want to set a minimum or a maximum. Now it's, hey, check a checkbox and put in some, you know, enable some values here on a per virtual network adapter setting. By the way, again, I should point out that all of these things can be set via PowerShell. So if I wanted to, you know, configure a whole bunch of setting, you know, configure bandwidth settings across all of the VMs on my server, I could do that via PowerShell. But very often, you know, you want to think about workloads in your environment that are mission critical and very important. So for example, for MySQL server is extremely important, and maybe I want to make sure that at a minimum it gets half a gigabit NIC. So it gets 512 megabits, okay? that could be an important minimum. On the other hand, I may have some workloads in my environment that honestly aren't that important, and the last thing I want them to do is soaking up all my bandwidth. So for example, hey, you know what, maybe the guys in the marketing team print out these huge posters every Friday out to the plotter, and you know what, I want to make sure they don't, you know, consume too much of my network bandwidth, so I'll give them a maximum of 100 megabits. So in this case, it may take them a little bit longer to print because they're throttled at 100 megabits, but at the same time, it means I've got plenty of headroom for other workloads. So that's something that's been warmly received, is quality of service and bandwidth management in Server 2012 networking. When it comes to hardware acceleration, one of the things we really wanted to do was take advantage of some of the latest advancements in your network adapters. And one of those advancements is something called Virtual Machine Queue, or VMQ. VMQ allows us to have the network adapter actually perform a whole bunch of optimizations and a whole bunch of lifting and copies that we used to have to do in the virtual switch, and allow the hardware to actually assign a queue between a physical NIC and a virtual machine. So this allows to get packets between the physical NIC and a specific virtual machine and avoid a number of copies and do this in a very highly optimized fashion.
So what does that give us?
It gives us performance and it gives us scale, because there's a number of things that the CPU doesn't need to do. And from a scalability standpoint, so from a performance standpoint, allows us to avoid the software having to do a bunch of copies in place, copies in the switch, and allows us to get better performance. And one of the things I get asked about is, well, you know, how many queues are in a network adapter? That really depends on the NIC. When the NICs first started supporting VMQs, I know some of the early virtual physical NICs supported, you know, 8 or 16. Now we're seeing physical NICs that support, you know, 64, you know, 96, 128 VMQs, which means every time the virtual machine fires up and a VMQ is available, it can take advantage of it to give you better performance. And you notice it's on by default. That's how strongly we feel about this feature, because you know what, if it's there, we want to take advantage of it. If the hardware doesn't support VMQ, then we'll fall back to an all software path that we've always done. Another example is IPsec task offloading. So one thing we're seeing as people are realizing we move to this cloud world where, you know, I don't know necessarily, my workload may live in a specific rack in a specific part of my data center today, but tomorrow it may live in a different data center, may live in a service provider, may live in a public cloud offering, could live in a variety of different places. And so what we're seeing is people want to do more end-to-end encryption. And so with IPsec task offload, what this means is we'll take advantage of the hardware NIC to do the encryption and decryption for us. If you're using Hyper-V in Server 2008 or 2008 R2, this option wasn't available. Wasn't available. So it meant that the encryption and decryption needed to happen within the virtual machine. If you're using Server 2012, and again, the feature is enabled by default, if your hardware supports it, then it will automatically do the hardware encryption and decryption in the NIC itself. And you know what's great about this is, you know, on a single machine, encryption and decryption may be a couple of percentage points on your CPU, but if you're running a dozen or a couple dozen, all of a sudden that adds up quite a bit, and it can take a sizable amount of your CPU. So if your VM, if your physical NIC supports this, then we'll give you that transparent encryption and decryption. So there's a bunch of things we've done here to really accelerate your hardware. Then finally, we've got this one at the bottom.
And SRIOV.
SRIOV. So this is kind of your network supercharger. SRIOV is very, very interesting. SRIOV is actually a standard defined by the PCI SIG. And what this allows us to do is take a portion of a physical NIC and actually map it into a VM. So today, if you go into Device Manager, in fact, let's go do that real quick. If I go into a virtual machine today, and if I go into Device Manager, and I am running, this is Server 2012, running in a Hyper-V VM, and if I go to the NIC, you'll see that it says it's a Microsoft Hyper-V network adapter. In fact, if I get properties on it, you'll see, yeah, lo and behold, it's written by Microsoft, and it's running on the Hyper-V virtual machine bus. And here are some of its advanced features, but it's a fully virtualized network adapter. It doesn't see the physical NIC. It doesn't know what type of NIC I have in this machine that I'm running on. It sees this synthetic NIC. Well, when you're running with SRIOV, What it means is we're actually taking a portion of that NIC and we're mapping it into the virtual machine itself. So if you enable SRIOV, what happens is you'll actually see, okay, I'm running on a physical NIC and it's an Intel NIC, for example, or maybe it's a Broadcom NIC. And guess what? In the VM, it actually sees it's an Intel NIC or it's a Broadcom NIC. Now, it doesn't see, when I say it uses a, maps a portion of it, with SRIOV, you basically, there's we kind of take the NIC and divide it into two portions. There's the control plane and the data plane. The data plane is literally where all the data is going across the bits. The control plane is how you manage the NIC itself. The control plane still lives in the management OS, in the management partition, whereas the data plane is where all the I.O. is going from the virtual machine to the physical NIC. So when you enable this, what's great about SRIOV is if you have a workload, a massive scale-up workload that requires, say, you know, 10-plus gigabits per second into a VM, or in fact, if you wanted to team two SRIOV NICs to get you, honest to goodness, 20 gigabits of NIC performance into a VM, this is how you do it. You enable SRIOV, and that gets mapped into the VM. Now, the one thing you have to understand is there is a trade-off. If you decide you want to use SRIOV, fantastic, you're talking to directly to the NIC. The trade-off is, if you enable SRIOV, you're talking directly to the NIC. You're not going through the virtual switch anymore. You're not going through the extensible virtual switch. So for example, I was talking to you about bandwidth management. I was talking to you about quality of service. Well, none of these matter anymore, because if you're using SRIOV, you're talking to directly to the NIC, you're not going through the virtual switch, and we can't apply any of the policy that we're using in the virtual switch. So it's not a bad thing or a good thing, it's just a consideration you have to keep in mind. And in general, when people ask me, Jeff, should I use SRIOV? Should I use VMQ? What should I use? My general recommendation is we really like VMQ. We like VMQ a lot, and that's the one I use by default. I think of SRIOV as more of a, you know what, if I've got a really mission-critical scale-up workload that I need to really provide that massive, you know, 10-plus gigabits performance into a VM, then SRIOV is going to be the way I do it. Finally, we've got some advanced features, and some of these advanced features are some nice new security features that we've added. So we have MAC address spoofing, DHCP guard, router advertisement guard. So let me kind of explain what these things do. When it comes to DHCP guard, especially say if you're a hosting provider, you want to make sure that no one accidentally or on purpose sets up a DHCP server that starts spouting off IP addresses in your infrastructure. Or you want to make sure that no one sets up an OS that pretends to be a router and is trying to get packets off the wire and break into the network infrastructure. So with these new features, you can enable DHCP guard, enable router advertisement guard. And essentially with DHCP guard, it drops any DHCP unauthorized VMs that are pretending to be and advertising themselves as DHCP servers. And the same thing is true for router guard. We basically drop router advertisements and redirection messages from VMs that are pretending to be routers. So for service providers especially that want to provide an extra level of security, DHCP guard and router guard some additional security capabilities built into the switch. And then for people that are interested in doing testing, debugging, they want to basically try and look at performance analysis or debug some networking things, we've also included port mirroring. Very often I'm asked about promiscuous mode, or Jeff, can I look at, you know, packets? And what you're really asking is, I really want to be able to monitor incoming and outgoing packets. And on a physical switch, you would enable port mirroring so that you could say, hey, I want to see everything that's going in and out of that port. And so with Hyper-V, we've done that. It's built right into the switch, and so you can determine whether it's the destination or source, and it allows you to do debugging of networking packets.
Great. Well, as I kind of look further down here, I see NIC teaming. Tell me a little bit about NIC teaming. What's it supported on? Can you use it on every network?
Yes. So NIC teaming is it's interesting. We've added NIC teaming in a variety of different ways and in a variety of different places in Server 2012. In Server 2012, forget about Hyper-V for just a moment, we've added NIC teaming to the platform itself. So for example, if I want to go in here, and if I want to go to my host machine, and I want to go in here and enable NIC teaming, I can go and take advantage of the new NIC teaming capabilities that are built into Windows Server 2012. Now, unfortunately, this machine I'm using right now only has a single NIC, but I could create a new team, and if I had multiple NICs here, you could see that I could just basically create a team, and then I could determine what type of load balancing mode. And by the way, it's load balancing and failover. It's active, and that's the way it's configured by default. So you get load balancing and failover. Within the virtual machine, though, we've also implemented teaming as an option here as well. So for example, I mentioned SROV just a moment ago. So take for the example the example that you have an application like a large scale-up SQL server, and it's running on a physical machine. And that physical machine has a whole bunch of cores, a whole bunch of memory, and it has two 10 gigabit NICs in there that are being used for load balancing and failover, because you're going to make sure that you have redundancy on your networking path. Well, you want to make sure that if you take that workload and you migrate it into a virtual machine, that you're not There are no trade-offs involved. Sure, I'm going to give it a whole bunch of virtual processors. I'm going to give it a whole bunch of memory. But at the same time, I want to make sure that teaming is also a capability provided in the virtual machine as well. So you can use the Server 2012 NIC teaming, enable that in the VM. And then the important thing is you also have to enable NIC teaming here for the VM itself. And there's a reason why you have to do this. For NIC teaming to work, you have to be able, the NIC teaming software has to be able to modify and make changes to MAC addresses. And so to be able to do that, it needs to have that capability enabled. We don't do this by default because we want to make sure that nothing is actually mucking around with your MAC addresses unless you specify that you want it to do that. So if you want to use NIC teaming in a VM, and in fact with SROV is a great way to do it, just enable NIC teaming here and then enable the new Server 2012 NIC teaming in the VM, and now you have a fully LBFO capable all the way into the virtual machine itself. So there's a whole bunch of new features in terms of networking in Server 2012.
Now, on a Hyper-V host, we obviously have different networks for different types of usage. How many networks should they have, and what are the different functionalities of the networks?
Boy, that's a great question. It's a loaded question. In fact, let me take a step back, because one of the questions I get asked very much related to that is the how many NICs should I have question.
Okay.
So before we get into the type of, you're right. Let's start with yours. Certainly, you're going to have a network for your virtual machines, at least a network for your virtual machines. If you're doing live migration and you're setting up clustering, of course, you're going to have a Heartbeat network, which will likely be the same as your management network. But you're going to have you're going to want a live migration network as well, so that your live migration traffic isn't being shared with others.
But we don't want it to interfere with the Heartbeat traffic,
exactly.
Log that, trigger any type of
exactly.
False failover.
And then finally, you have to think about storage. So are you using storage are you using fiber channel storage, or are you using direct attached storage? If that's the case, then you don't have to worry about networking. But what if you're using iSCSI for networking and you're using that for storage? Or what if you're using SMB and you're using the new Windows Server 2012 scale-out file server? Well, then you want to make sure that you've got networks dedicated for that as well, because you don't want your storage traffic, your live migration traffic, and your network traffic all fighting for the same bandwidth. Now, in the past, one of the things you would do generally is gigabit NICs were fairly inexpensive, and people would generally drop in a whole bunch of gigabit NICs, and we'd see we'd see servers with 5-6 NICs in there, and it becomes kind of a pain to manage them all. We're now kind of reaching the point now where we're seeing servers by default shipping out of the factory with 210 gig NICs on the back. And nothing makes me happier to see that. Because honestly, it allows us to be a lot more flexible, allows us to do a lot more in terms of capability, as well as provide you headroom for growth by being able to do that. So I'm not telling you have to have 210 gig NICs. If you want to go with a whole bunch of gigabit NICs, and in fact, if you want to take a whole bunch of gigabit NICs, team them together, and then carve them up, go for it. You can certainly do that. Certainly, the recommended way, if someone said, Jeff, I'm building a new server today, what should I use? I'd say, you know what? I'd drop in 210 gig NICs to start with. Because what you can now do is with Server 2012, you can basically aggregate. You can create a team, two 10 gigabit NICs into a team. And now you can basically carve up all of that in software. And what's nice about that is it gives you flexibility. You may realize, you know what, I'm going to set up my cluster network and my virtual machine network, my live storage, my live migration network, my management network, etc. Do all of this in software, and if I need to fine-tune and tweak later, we can do that. But honestly, by going with 210 gig NICs, it also gives you the headroom for growth. So you know, those are a number of the strategies. We actually have some white papers that are available up on TechNet that explain in detail, and in fact, we're working on even more documentation to talk about how to configure these. But essentially, you know, you have to understand you've got a live migration network, you've got a VM network for all your virtual machine traffic to go across, you've got your potentially storage traffic if you're using iSCSI or SMB. Now, again, if you're using Direct Attach or something else, then you may not need that. And of course, there's a management network as well. And I know you're going to be showing off clustering a little bit, so I don't want to talk too much about all of that. I want you to be able to show all this off in your
code
demo.
Sounds good. But I think the bottom line really is you want to distribute or separate the networks by function. That's kind of the bottom line, right? You got your cluster function, live migration function, management function, backup, storage, that type of thing. But since you mentioned storage, we've actually got a few questions coming in from the UK here. Before I dive into any of the specifics, why don't you just give us an overview of what's new in Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V storage? Another area of major investment.
Yes, there is so much new when it comes to storage. So let's talk about, there's so much new, the way I kind of divide it up is we made investments in both block-based storage as well as file-based storage. And this kind of allows me to kind of easily delineate, because a lot of people, you know, tend to think about storage in those terms. When it comes to block-based storage, so let's start with the work that we did, for example, for SANS. We did a tremendous investment in a number of areas where Hyper-V interfaces with fiber channel and storage area networks. So first of all, there's virtual fiber channel. Let me be very clear here. If you own a fiber channel SAN, if you have a fiber channel SAN infrastructure, if that's, you know, the basis, your backbone for your storage, Server 2012 is literally a no-brainer. It's literally just go get the bits and start installing it right now, because we did a tremendous amount of work to basically integrate and take advantage of the new capabilities of your SAN, as well as harness virtual fiber channel into a VM. So for example, with virtual fiber channel, we present an honest to goodness fiber channel HBA into the VM. Now, this is very different. There are other ways that other VM vendors have implemented fiber channel. I would say they're, quite honestly, not optimal. I'm going to be polite here. We did this. We were very thoughtful about how we did our development and how we implemented virtual fiber channel. And we did it very much to mimic the ways that storage administrators are used to administering, configuring, and zoning and masking fiber channel for physical machines. So one of the important first things to understand is, if you know how to zone and mask your physical fiber channel storage out there, you already know how to do it for Hyper-V. So I always get asked, what's special? What do I need to know? What sort of secret incantation? Actually, there is nothing. It's very, very straightforward. Within the virtual machine, you'll see a fiber channel HBA. Okay, it is a Microsoft fiber channel HBA. What this means is, now when I install my applications and my OS inside the virtual machine, it means that I can take advantage of all those capabilities that I'm used to using fiber channel for. So for example, other guys didn't implement it that way. They implemented it using kind of a pass-through disk sort of mechanism. They didn't really do the full HBA implementation, which means to a lot of compromises. Hyper-V doesn't have those compromises. Because we did a native HBA implementation, you can use MPIO. You can use guest clustering. Okay, we don't have any of those limitations. So if you want to again, take a scale-up workload that was running on a physical machine that most likely was using MPIO and move into a virtual machine, you're not going to take a trade-off there. It's not going to be, oh, by the way, if you virtualize it, you can't use MPIO. That's not the way we went. With Server 2012, with Hyper-V, it's a first-class Hyper-V fiber channel implementation. MPIO works. Guest clustering works. If you use DSM software, like EMC PowerPath, for example, that just works in a Hyper-V VM. So it gives you all those capabilities you expect to use. From the standpoint of hardware requirements, so let me be very clear here. From a fiber channel standpoint, the HBA has to have drivers for 2012. Okay, so it has to be a certified HBA for 2012. You may have an HBA that works today great with Server 2008 R2. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work with 2012, because while the hardware may work, you have to have an updated driver, because there were some new APIs and new function calls that we needed to implement to make virtual fiber channel work, and so the vendors needed to update their drivers. So please check with your HBA vendor to make sure that they have 2012 certified HBAs. So number one, that you have to have driver support. Number two, your heart, your fiber channel HBA has to support NPIV. Okay, NPIV, endpoint virtualization for fiber channel, has been around actually for a long, long time. You can even find it way back on some of the early fiber channel cards. I think even some 2 gigabit fiber channel cards had NPIV on it. That's how old it is. So if you have even a modestly a 4 gig fiber channel 8 or something newer, very good chance it already supports NPIV, but again, you have to have the driver support. So NPIV has to be enabled on the HBA. Furthermore, you have to have a switch. So you can't just have a fiber channel HBA plugged right into some storage device. There has to be a switch. Now, sometimes the SAN device has implemented a switch right onto the storage device, so you may be set there. But some lower cost storage device may not have an integrated switch, so do understand you have to have a switch. Then finally, the switch fabric has to have NPIV enabled. Okay, so I've seen a number of cases where someone said, you know what, I did the right thing, I have the 2012 drivers, I enabled NPIV on the fiber channel port, but it still says the fabric doesn't support virtual fiber channel. That to me is the clear indicator, oh, you didn't set it on the actual fiber channel switch port itself. So make sure that you go take a look at the individual port and make sure that NPIV is enabled there as well, because it has to be enabled throughout the entire chain. With that, it allows us, your virtual machine now can now access full on your SAN infrastructure. And this works with, you know, the devices out there, your storage devices out there on your SANs, and you simply zone and mask the same way you would a physical machine. So worldwide node names, worldwide port names, that's all part of Hyper-V and virtual fiber channel.
Now, what about Hyper-V over SMB?
What about Hyper-V over SMB?
That's one of the most popular. Yes. We've already got 3 or 4 questions on that here.
Yes. So SMB, we've made a huge investment on the file side of the house. So actually, let me mention one more thing about the block side, which is offloaded data transfer, ODX. So ODX is a new capability we built into Server 2012 to really harness the power built into your SAN. There's a lot of capabilities built into the SAN, and what we wanted to do was offload some of the work from the server to the SAN itself. So for example, if I just want to do a copy, if I want to copy 10 terabytes from one part of my storage array to the next, in the past with Server 2008 R2, I would basically go to the SAN, I would read, and then I would write. And I would read, and I would write. And I would move the 10 terabytes, it would be copy, we'd make sure the whole thing got there, but there would be a whole bunch of CPU utilization on the server, there'd be a whole bunch of I/O that goes across the storage fabric, and honestly, it could take quite a while. It could take hours or even days to move 10 terabytes. So that's how we did it in the past. With Server 2012, we actually go to the storage array and say, do you support ODX? The storage array comes back and says, why, yes, I do. Great. Here's a secure token. Please go perform the copy. And so what ends up happening is now the storage array can do the copy, the 10 terabyte copy itself. It may not actually even need to do a copy. It could literally be moving just pointers on the SAN. So something that could take hours or even days could be done in minutes or even seconds.
Wow.
So offloaded data transfer is a huge capability. And be very clear here. When people ask me about block storage, I tell them, if you're getting ready to buy a brand new SAN, the first question should be, does this thing support ODX? If it doesn't, it's not worth your time. Because once you see ODX, you're going to go, why didn't I buy that? Why didn't I make sure that my new SAN had that feature? So please, talk to your storage vendor if you're getting ready to make that new investment in a SAN, and make sure that it does have ODX, that it's there. On the file side of the house, we made some huge investments with the file server. So in the file server, the file server offers a whole rich new set of features. In fact, one of the biggest, one of my only complaints about what we did in Server 2012 is I kind of wish we would have renamed the file server, because a lot of people tend to think of it as just the same old file server that we've had in Server 2008 or 2008 R2, which could not be farther from the truth than what we have in 2012. With Server 2012, the file server has rich new sets of capabilities. One of the biggest things it has is the ability to be a scale-out file server. So now, instead of just setting up a single file server and saying, or even clustering a single file server, we can now set up a scale out file server, and it could be 2 nodes, it could be 4 nodes, it could be all the way up to 8 nodes. And we put direct attached storage JBODs behind it, some inexpensive JBODs behind it, but we use the file server as the front end, and we use spaces as the way to carve up, virtualize all of those JBODs and present LUNs. The file server is really the front end that provides the interface to all of your servers. And that interface is now supercharged with SMB3. And with Windows Server 2012 and Hyper-V talking to the file server with SMB3 is an extremely optimized experience now. We made a whole bunch of changes in SMB itself. It's why the version number ticked up from 2 to version 3, because it's just, they're huge in terms of performance capabilities, scalability capabilities. We have multi-channel support, much more resilient, and performance improvements across the board. So if you haven't taken a look at the new Server 2012 file server, or if you were installing some new capabilities in Server 2012 and you saw the file server, don't think it's the file server that you saw in the past. We're seeing some honestly ridiculous performance. We demoed publicly on a number of occasions the ability to copy over 16 gigabytes per second to a Windows Server 2012 file server. Again, 16 gigabytes, not bits, per second. We're talking nearly 4 DVDs per second to the new Windows Server 2012 file server. So we've unlocked a whole bunch of new capabilities and performance. Some of this has been in the file server itself, some of it's been in there, but a bunch of it has been in the SMB3 protocol itself. So my next point will be, if you're getting ready to make a file purchase, A, take a look at the file server, and B, if you're getting ready to buy a standalone like NASBox, make sure that you ask that vendor, does it have SMB3 support? If it doesn't, go talk to the next vendor, or make sure, or say, no, show me the version that does have SMB3. Because again, like ODX, once you see SMB3 in action, you're gonna go, why didn't I buy the version that had SMB3 in it? So don't make a mistake and buy something that only has SMB2. And heaven forbid, if it's SMB1, Don't walk away, run away. SMB1 is a 20-plus-year-old protocol technology. It's not even worth your time. Make sure you're looking at SMB3.
Great. Now, if some of our customers or attendees out there are having any issues with the live Q&A, feel free to switch over to the Help tab. Try asking your question on the Help tab, and we'll make sure it gets addressed there. But one of the questions that I have seen come up from one of our customers in India, they're currently using pass-through disks. What's our view on using pass-through disks with Windows Server 2012 and all of these other enhancements we've made?
Great question. So let me give you a little bit of history of pass-through disks so you can kind of explain why pass-through disks exist, what their uses were, and kind of how we feel about them in 2012. So if you go all the way back to Windows Server 2008, our very first release of Hyper-V. Back then, we offered fixed disks, dynamically expanding disks, differencing disks, and we had pass-through disks. And a pass-through disk is essentially where we take a LUN that's mapped into the host, in the host partition, and we actually provide that LUN into the VM. It's not a virtual disk, it's the full-on LUN. So there's no VHD involved, and you're actually writing directly to the pass-through disk. There were two real reasons why we did pass-through disks in Server 2008. I'm going to be very transparent here. Number one was performance. We had very good fixed disk performance. We were very close to native performance. We were probably, in 2008, I believe we were about 92% to 95% of native performance. But people said, I want to be able to get every last drop of performance out of there. So we said, okay, fine, we'll do pass-through disks. The other reason why you wanted pass-through disks was you needed to access data volumes greater than 2 terabytes, because basically, VHDs were limited to about, to be precise, 2,040 gigabytes or almost 2 terabytes. And honestly, this has been the case across all virtualization vendors. If you look at VMware and Xen today, for example, they still are limited to 2 terabytes. In Windows Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V, we actually goose the performance of fixed disks. In fact, fixed disks in Server 2008 R2 are equivalent to native performance. Full stop. So think about that for a second. In Server 2008 R2, a virtual fixed disk is equivalent to native performance. So at that point, why would you use a pass-through disk? You don't really need it for performance anymore, because I can already give it to you in a fixed disk. Also, because it's in a VHD, it's encapsulated, so I can move it around. And the other nice benefit is it doesn't consume an entire LUN. The only reason why you really needed a pass-through disk in Server 2008 R2 was, again, well, I need to access a LUN one that's greater than 2 terabytes. So, you know, we saw less and less people using pass-through disks, which honestly is a good thing. And we saw the real reason to use pass-through disks in Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V was really, hey, I need to access something that's on greater than 2 terabytes. Now let's take a look at where we are with Server 2012. With Server 2012, performance is simply not an issue. We can deliver millions of IOPS into a single VM from storage. Fixed disk performance is native. In fact, on dynamically expanding disks, we drastically improved performance. I actually think this is an area we probably haven't talked to enough, but in Server 2012, if you're using the new VHDX format and you're using dynamically expanding disks, we're getting pretty close to native. We're not native performance yet, but we're approaching, you know, the 90 plus percentage point now with dynamically expanding VHDXs. And there's a number of reasons why we do that. One of the biggest reasons is we automatically align now. There are no alignment issues with, you know, with whatever sector size you want to use on the physical disk. We've also improved a whole bunch of optimizations internally with how we deal with dynamically expanding disks. So all of a sudden, dynamically expanding disk performance is very good, very good. But fixed disk performance is native. So again, performance is not an issue. So the other reason to use a pass-through disk again was, well, I need to access a volume greater than 2 terabytes. Well, guess what? We solved that problem. In Server 2012, I can create virtual disks up to 64 terabytes per virtual disk. So all of a sudden now, guess what? Why do I use a pass-through disk? And in fact, at this point in time, it's hard for me. I struggle to come up with a single reason why I would use a pass-through disk anymore. Now, I know there may be people watching online going, what? Did he say I don't need to use pass-through disks anymore? But those other virtualization vendors say that I should be using their raw disks mode or their pass-through disk equivalent. I get it. That's what the other guys may be telling you. Hyper-V and Server 2012 really doesn't have those limitations. And in fact, there's a bunch of reasons why you kind of don't want to use pass-through disks. I'll give you a prime example. If you need to provide a physical LUN into a VM, we have better ways to do it. If you need to get a full LUN into a VM, use virtual fiber channel, because again, we gave that to you in 2012. If you want to do it over iSCSI, run the iSCSI target in the virtual machine and you get a full iSCSI LUN in the virtual machine. In addition, by using virtual fiber channel iSCSI, you get MPIO. If you use a pass-through disk, by the way, this is true of the other vendors as well, you don't get MPIO. So that's actually a big takeaway. It's actually a kind of a big downside to using pass-through disks because you don't get that that type of mode. So optimally, we really recommend the best thing to do is stick with virtual disks as much as possible. If you need the absolute utmost in performance, fixed disks are the way to go. Dynamically expanding VHDX in Server 2012 is an awesome way because you get thin provision storage. And by the way, it's extremely fast. So that's the other way to go. If you need to get a real, honest to goodness, full entire LUN into a VM, then fine. Use virtual fiber channel or use iSCSI. At this point in time, again, I struggle to come up with really any reason why I would use pass-through disks. It also complicates live migration. If you want to do live migration, in fact, here's one important thing to know. If you want to take advantage of the new live migration capabilities in Server 2012, one of the new ones is shared nothing live migration. If you want to do live migration with a pass-through disk today, it actually works. But because the resource is a pass-through disk that's outside the purview of the virtual machine, you actually have to set up the pass-through disk as a cluster resource to actually do the live migration. That works, and you can live migrate VMs with a pass-through disk today. However, with shared nothing live migration, where you're literally live migrating a VM between different clusters, if you have a pass-through disk, you can't use shared nothing live migration. So again, I struggle to come up really with any reason why I use pass-through disk, and honestly, we've got better solutions. Use fixed disks, use dynamic disks, and if you need to get a LUN into a VM, use iSCSI or virtual fiber channel.
Well, great answer. I bet you've been asked that question before, right?
Actually, it's something we're just starting to see a little bit more of, and people are kind of asking, you know, does it make sense to use pass-through disk? And I realize this would probably be a great time to really explain that.
Great. Well, moving on topics a little bit, we mentioned Linux OS earlier. What type of Linux servers, distributions, can we run inside our guest operating operating system.
Yeah, we continue to crank along on this, and I know this is always a lot of people that are kind of in shock when I explain this to them, but we've had a team working very hard on Linux integration services, which continue to be implemented in the source code is actually GPLv2, and it's in the Linux kernel today. If you download the latest version of Red Hat, CentOS, I even downloaded Linux Mint, Ubuntu, Debian, etc. The integration services are already built into the Linux kernel. So if you go download the latest version of Mint, for example, and you just take the ISO, put it in Hyper-V and install it, guess what? The distro has all of our drivers. When the OS boots up, it finds auto plugs and plays all of our devices, our networking, our storage, etc. And guess what? It just works. Now, if you want the official list, you can go right on over to our TechNet article and you can see the distro versions and all of those things. But let's talk about support for just a second, because I get asked this question all the time. Jeff, if I use Red Hat or CentOS, does this mean Microsoft supports Linux and you're going to support me end to end? And it's like, well, hold on here. If you were to download CentOS, and let's say I stuck it on a physical machine that I purchased from a server vendor, you'd call that server. You wouldn't call the server vendor. You would basically call up where you got the distro. So if it was Red Hat and you get support with Red Hat, then you'd call up Red Hat. If it's CentOS, it's community-led support. So you got to go to the community and ask for support. If it's a question about the Linux integration services, then absolutely we will definitely help you, and we've got support mechanisms in place. We're on the community forums and we have support in place, but there's a lot of confusion about what support means. It's like, hey, I installed the Linux integration services, so does this mean that, you know, Microsoft's going to help me debug the Linux kernel? It's like, well, let's understand.
Probably not.
I just want to be transparent. It's like, look, if it's a Linux question, go to the community or go to your distro vendor for support, because that's what they do. If it's the integration services itself, then we're absolutely happy to help you. And again, we are developing more capabilities, we're adding more, and you're going to see even more development going into the Linux integration services in the near future.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to move on to a different topic now. You started to mention live migration, so I'm starting to see kind of a few cluster questions come in. So I'm going to take the first question here. What are the new types of live migration we have? Well, first of all, let me just define live migration. Live migration gives us the ability to move a running virtual machine from one physical host to another physical host with no downtime. It would be functionally equivalent to a vMotion if you're familiar with VMware. And so we supported live migration since 2008 R2, but we really wanted to enhance that, provide more mobility, and really be able to move our virtual machines between clusters, between data centers, with no downtime. So first type of new live migration we support is live migration over SMB. And in this case, we have, let's say, a file share. I have server 1 that's non-clustered, server 2 that's non-clustered, and I can simply live migrate my virtual machines between those different hosts with zero downtime to my virtual machines and my applications within them. We're simply copying the memory over the network and then redirecting our clients from that first server over to the second server. The second new type of live migration we support is storage live migration. This would be equivalent to a storage vMotion. And in this case, we have my virtual machine that's running on a host, and let's say I need to do some maintenance to my back-end storage. I need to go fix a disk, expand it, contract it. Well, what we're doing here is simply copying our VHD or VHDX file from that one storage location to another storage location with, again, no downtime to that virtual machine. And then we thought, wow, so we can move the VM, we can move the storage, but wouldn't it be great if we could move them both at the same time and have shared nothing live migration? And we've now added support for that, being one of the leaders in the industry. And so you can literally move a running virtual machine with the storage on a file share to a different host, simultaneously moving both the virtual machine, its in-state memory, and its storage with no downtime at all. So kind of a great solution to really give you mobility beyond a single host, beyond a cluster, and go cluster to cluster as well. Now, next question that I get asked a lot is, okay, so you can live migrate between clusters, between standalone hosts. Why do I need a cluster anymore? Well, remember, there are two types of availability and two types of downtime that we have. And what we can do with the live migration is work around planned downtime. If you know that the server needs to go offline, It needs to be patched. It needs maintenance. You need to update the storage. You can plan for this. And so you can perform a live migration with no downtime and move your virtual machines around. But anytime you do a live migration, you need both servers, both nodes, actively participating in the live migration. They're copying in-state memory. And so what this means is, if one of the servers just crashes, that virtual machine is going to go offline because we are not copying that in-state memory. So the key thing with clustering is it protects you for unplanned downtime as well. Within a cluster, up to 64 nodes, every node is simultaneously monitoring the health of every other node. So if one of my servers crashes, the other server can detect it's down and automatically restart. So again, to summarize, live migration is used with planned downtime. Failover clustering is used with unplanned downtime. So clustering is absolutely still essential.
And Simon, I'm so glad you bring that up, because people do need to understand, we've talked a lot about the new Shared Nothing Live Migration capabilities. And one thing I always like to be very transparent about is Shared Nothing Live Migration is a mobility feature. It is not an HA feature. If I have two servers and I don't set up a cluster and I take down a physical host, it goes down. So make sure you understand the difference between the two. Clustering is great for both planned and unplanned downtime. Now, speaking of clusters, can you talk a little bit about what the upgrading of a cluster kind of looks like?
Great question. I really get that a lot. You know, everyone's excited to move to Windows Server 2012. I mean, I don't know, Jeff's maybe mentioned 100 features at least already today. So a lot of people are saying, hey, what's the easiest way to go and move my old cluster over to my new cluster? And I actually have a demo that I can show. A couple weeks ago, we did a live demo for the Edge show, aka.ms/edge, which is basically our weekly webcast. And so I already have the demo set up. So if we could switch over, I'm actually going to show you my Windows Server 2012 cluster and my Windows Server 2008 R2 cluster. And the way we do a migration between these two is basically point to our old cluster, figure out the groups, and pull them over to our new cluster. So we can see right now on my new cluster, I just have a few roles running here. Let me quickly switch back to my old cluster here. This is my, it's my 2008 R2 cluster. And we can see that I currently have two virtual machines here. So what I'm going to do is actually copy these two virtual machines over. Now, while I actually do that, you know, first question I get asked is, can I mix my cluster nodes? And so what I mean by that is, can I have a cluster with a 2008 R2 node and a cluster with a Windows Server 2012 node? No, that is not supported. All of your cluster nodes must be running the same version of Windows. The next common question I get is, okay, as I do this, can I live migrate? Meaning, can I move my virtual machine from my old version to my new version with no downtime? Unfortunately not. Again, since these are different families, live migration has been significantly enhanced in the newer release. So you cannot do a live movement from the old version to the new version. We still are essentially doing an import and an export. And what I'm going to show you here is the cluster migration wizard. So on my new cluster, I'm going to select Migrate Roles. And this launches the Migrate to Cluster wizard. Now, what we're basically doing here is we're going to go and specify the name of my old cluster, so Simon Cloud R21. And it's going to connect to the old cluster, make sure I have access, and then it's going to go and list all of the different groups which are eligible for migration. Now, every time we do anything with a cluster, we have the option to have reports as well. So it's going to tell us what roles should be migratable, what roles will not be migratable. So we can kind of understand some expectations ahead of time. I can see like available storage, not going to be able to be migratable. My file server can be migratable. I need some additional steps. But it looks like right now my two virtual machines are good. So I'm going to go ahead and select my virtual machines. Now, in this case, they're running on the same CSV disk, so they're going to be migrated together. Now, another enhancement we've added is the ability to remap your virtual networks. So on one host, on one cluster, you probably have a virtual network, let's say network one. On the new cluster, you probably have a different virtual network, network two. So we really wanted to minimize the downtime as part of this process. And so we can actually give you the ability to remap your old virtual networks to your new virtual networks and update the virtual machine configuration file. I'm going to confirm. click next, and we're going to migrate these roles. Now, what we actually do is we're basically copying all of the data across, but we're not actually bringing those old virtual machines offline. So we're copying the VHD configuration information, the virtual machine configuration information, but we're not bringing those VMs online. And the reason why, we find out that a lot of people like to test the migration before having to do it live. So we're testing it, everything looks good. So I'm going to click Finish, and if I go take a look at my roles, I can see that I now have my two virtual machines, but they're in an offline state. Now, let's actually do the switch over and see how quick this is. Now, one other consideration you have is what happens to the VM storage. Now, you can reuse the same storage. You can actually do a file copy and copy it to new storage. But just to keep it simple, I'm reusing the same storage here. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go and switch to my old cluster here. Sorry, that's my new cluster. I'm going to switch to my old cluster here, and I'm going to bring my two virtual machines offline. So this is when you have downtime. So as of right now, my VMs are running. They're still serving customers. I'm going to gracefully shut them down. I'm going to do that on both. And then I'm going to go and detach my cluster shared volumes. So I'm going to bring this CSV disk offline as well. So right now I have downtime, my VMs are off. But what you're going to see is this is really minimal. I mean, you can do this switchover in, simply put, less than a minute. So as I switch back to my 2012 cluster, I'm going to go over to my CSV disk, bring it online. Perfect. Switch over to my virtual machines in Windows Server 2012. We can multi-select as well. Start those virtual machines. And what you've seen here is a migration. I've moved from my old version to my new version with about 1 minute of downtime for the actual virtual machines themselves. Now, what a migration wizard is basically a glorified export-import operation from the Hyper-V commandlets. So we basically wrapped it up, given it a nice GUI on top, and then using this process, you can go and easily migrate your virtual machines between the clusters. Now, Jeff, anything else come in related to our clustering question?
So, one of the things I saw in terms of clustering was multi-site clusters.
Ooh, good question.
And they kind of want to know how that relates to Replica. So why don't you start off with multi-site clusters, because I'm seeing a bunch of questions about Replica here as well, so we'll get to that in a second.
Sounds great. So multi-site clustering, this is essentially a disaster recovery solution where you can stretch your cluster between different data centers. Now, why is this important? Okay, let's think just in the last year. We've had wildfires, we've had earthquakes, we've had tsunamis, we've had major hurricanes hit and take out entire regions of the country. If you're really thinking about service continuity, you need to think about not just can I survive the failure of a server, of a virtual machine, of a rack. We're now really thinking data center high availability as well. How can I actually move my resources, my services, from one data center to another data center that could be across the state, the country, or even on different continents around the world? And that's where multi-site clustering comes in. Essentially, what we can do is set up either a large cluster or clusters at different locations and copy the data between, making them highly available. Now, with traditional multi-site clustering, before 2012, we'd basically stretch our cluster between the two sites, have a few nodes at one site, have a few nodes at a second site, and these nodes would still be monitoring the health of each other. When one site went down, the other site would pick up the resources and bring them online. Now, the biggest limitation we saw with our customers was that we needed to have a data replication solution provided by a third party. Think about it. Your first data center goes offline entirely. Well, you need that data to still be accessible at your second location so that it can be brought online. And for the data to be copied between the two sites, you're going to need some replication solution. Now, there's a lot of great partners out there that offer block-level replication, file-level replication, or even application replication, such as SQL database mirroring, log shipping with Exchange, DFS replication for files. So there are a bunch of solutions out there. But it was still a challenge adding this additional support for replication. And so with Windows Server 2012, we introduced the Hyper-V Replica. And what the Hyper-V Replica does is it allows us to basically take snapshots of virtual machines and every 5 minutes copy them to a different location. Now, the first time you perform a copy, it's going to do a full backup, actually take a copy of that entire virtual machine. After that initial copy, it's then only going to track the changes, the deltas, and replicate those changes from the first site over to the second site. Now, does this mean that if there's a crash, you will not lose data? Unfortunately not. Since we are replicating every 5 minutes, if you've replicated, have a crash 4 minutes later, you could potentially lose 4 minutes of data. So you always have to keep this in mind. This does not guarantee a continual availability. But what a great solution is, it's inbox, it's free, it's easy to set up, and it's easy to configure. So you now can have an inbox replication solution for your virtual machines. Now, this kind of changed how multi-site clustering worked in Windows Server 2012. Again, in the past, we had a single cluster stretching across the sites. With Windows Server 2012, we actually now have two separate clusters, one at the first site, one at the second site, and our replication is happening from the first site over to the second site. And what we do with a cluster is we can configure what's called a Hyper-V replica broker, which is basically a highly available replication service, and that service is then going to copy from our first site over to our second site. So now a great free inbox solution.
You know what? Let's actually walk through a Hyper-V replica for just a moment.
Cool. You want to switch over?
Yeah,
to can
we
demo
do that?
Here?
Let's switch on over to my demo machine for just a second here. I'm getting a number of people asking about Hyper-V replica, and so I thought, you know what? Let me just set this up and let's just walk through one. So I've got two machines here, by the way. One of these is in my office. The other one of these is across campus. So these are running across our Microsoft CorpNet. This is all over Gigabit Ethernet. Nothing special here. This is literally a desktop machine with a single spindle, and this is another desktop machine with another spindle, but these are located probably mile and a half from each other. So I'm going to walk through and configure replication. So as Simon mentioned, Hyper-V Replica is really a solution that we provided in the box. It's asynchronous application consistent VM replication. That's quite a mouthful, so let me kind of walk through and explain how you configure it and what it's designed to do. So I'm going to enable replication. I right-click on a VM, and I'm just going to replicate this to my second machine. You can see there's a number of different options here for replication. I can use Kerberos, or I can use a certificate-based authentication. Now, in my case, Kerberos is fine because I'm doing this on the Microsoft campus. This is all on Microsoft CorpNet. This isn't going over the public internet. HTTP is fine, and you'll notice it even says data will not be encrypted while being transmitted over the network. So this is just happening over the network. If I wanted, though, to say I'll replicate this up to a service provider and it was going to go over the public internet, then certainly I would want this encrypted, and so I could use certificate-based. So HTTPS is also an option. So if this is something, say, for example, you wanted to replicate VMs between multiple sites and you wanted to set up a site-to-site and this was going to go over the public internet, then HTTPS would work. If you wanted to go to a service provider, you could do that as well. Also notice that we have compression on. Compression is on by default, and on average we see anywhere between 60-70% savings using our compression. We want to make sure that we're using your network resources most efficiently. So that's what's going basically on here in this first one. On the second one, basically it says, you know, I can choose which virtual disks I'm going to replicate. I'm going to replicate both disks. And now I can choose my recovery history. Now, by default, we're going to go with only the latest recovery history. You can see it's going to use 3.58 gigabytes. Yes. And now I'm going to enable additional recovery points. So what I can do is I say, you know what, instead of keeping the last 4 recovery points, you know, maybe I want to keep the last 8 recovery points, and it automatically recalculates the amount of storage needed for that replicated virtual machine. Or maybe, you know what, this is something that's super important, I'm willing to keep the last 15 recovery points. So if I want to go back to a different point in time or have multiple points in time because I just want that flexibility in case something really bad happens, I could do that. But by default, we stick with the latest recovery point, and even then, if you want, we go with 4. In addition, we also do volume shadow services. So VSS is an operating system capability of Windows, where basically we can tell it's an application consistent snapshot. What we do is we basically alert an application or applications that we're about to perform a snapshot. What this does is it tells the applications you need to properly flush everything, quiesce everything to disk, so that everything, all of the state of the application is safely on disk. Then once that happens, we take the snapshot, and this way we have an application consistent snapshot. So if you're running something like SQL or a file server or something that's VS aware, you're going to want to enable it. Now by default it's off, because we don't know what the workload is. If you're running, for example, Linux has no concept of VSS. Or if you're running a workload in Windows, it's not VSS aware, then you know what, that just doesn't make sense to do that. So if you do have VSS aware, you do want to check it. And again, you can also configure how often you take that VSS aware snapshot. So I'm going to go ahead and stick with the default, and I'm going to click on Next. Now, one of the other challenges of replication is that first replication. That initial replication can actually be a pretty sizable one. So say, for example, I have a workload that I've been running for years, and it's actually 60 gigabytes, and I want to replicate this to my target location, but my pipes aren't the biggest, okay? So, maybe 60 gigabytes could take me hours or even days to replicate the entire thing. Now, certainly I could do it. There's nothing wrong with that, and I could replicate the entire 60 gigabytes. It'll take as long as, basically it's proportional to the size of the pipes and how much bandwidth I have. On the other hand, you may say, you know what, I'd like to get this over quickly so I can send that initial copy using external media. So,
like a thumb drive or
something? Like a thumb drive or a DVD drive or a Blu-ray, or put it on a USB disk and mail, FedEx the whole disk to my target location, copy it there, and then we only have to sync the diffs.
Nice.
So this is, really efficient in terms of how we want to deal with that initial replication. The other thing you may want to do is you may want to schedule that initial replication. So I'm going to start it right now, but it's a work day here at Microsoft, and maybe I'd actually like to wait till the end of the week. Maybe I'm going to do this on a Friday, and in fact I'm going to do it at 11 p.m. because I'm figuring most people have probably left work by Friday 11 p.m. around here. So I will have all of the network bandwidth available to me, or at least much more available bandwidth instead of during the work hour. And so this will have the replication start on a Friday, and it'll go over the weekend, and I can take advantage of not too many people being in the office. You can schedule it. So I'm going to start my replication immediately. I'm going to do this over the network, and literally there it is. So I get my summary, and I'm going to go ahead and begin the replication, and I'm going to click on Finish, and now I'm enabling the replication. And you can see that replication enabled successfully. Now, you'll notice it's actually not done yet. It comes up with another dialog and says, great, replication has begun, but do you want to configure the replication network connectivity? And this is an important part of replication, because imagine what happens in the case of a real disaster recovery. You have Site 1 and Site 2. Site 1 could literally be on 10.0.0.1, and Site 2 is on 192.168, and I've got two different IP address range. So all of a sudden, Site 1 is burned down. It no longer exists. And now I need to bring up these VMs on Site 2 on a completely different IP address range, and this needs to magically come up and everything to just magically work. How do you configure that network connectivity? Well, one of the things that happens when you enable replication on a VM is if you go to the network adapter, we actually populate it with some additional settings, such as failover TCP IP. So here now, I can go into this VM, and I can give it specific IP addresses, specific subnet masks, give it the preferred DNS server, the alternate DNS server, and I can do this for both IPv4 and IPv6. So in the case of that failover, I could say, you know what? When we start the VMs up in the new location, Hyper-V will inject these new settings into the network stack, into the virtual machine, so then when it comes up on the new network with these new IP address settings. And so this happens automatically. Now, there are a couple of ways you can solve this really pretty huge problem of how do you deal with this network move from Site 1 to Site 2. This is certainly one way to do it. The other way would to take advantage of the new network virtualization capabilities that we built in the Server 2012. So if you've heard over the last 12 to 16 months, everyone's been talking about software-defined networking and the ability to create networks that allow me to span locations and be able to take my network to the cloud with me. That's actually an incredibly important capability, so important that we built it in the Server 2012. So while other companies were off buying, and making major acquisitions, we just built this capability right in the Server 2012 with network virtualization. And then the management of network virtualization is done through System Center. So there's a couple of different ways you can solve the whole issue of how do network settings and how do VMs move across different sites. And Replica includes its own capability built right into the box. So if you're not using network virtualization, you can use this capability as is. And if you are using network virtualization, they don't need to set up anything. And you can see that this VM is replicating right now. I'm about 37% of the way across. Not bad considering, again, this is about a mile and a half right now across campus right now over gigabit Ethernet. And of course, it's a work day here at Microsoft, so there's plenty of people on the network. So that's a little bit, very quickly, how you set up Replica.
Great demo. Now, we have an awesome question coming here from Brazil. Tell me about cluster aware updating. What is this new cluster patching feature everyone's been talking about? So something that I'm personally passionate about was just making cluster patching easier. Back when I was on the cluster engineering team, I was responsible for running all of our demo machines, which was dozens and dozens of clusters. And patching is a nightmare. Even internal, even though we get, you know, kind of the special internal access, Jeff and I, we still have compliance. We still need to keep our servers up to date, make sure they're not vulnerable. So we are still feeling that same pain of regularly patching our servers. And on a cluster, isn't that a repetitive task, right? You take the first node, put it into, you pause it, drain all the roles, patch it, reboot, check for dependent patches, unpause it, move everything back, and then repeat. But think how much worse that could have been with Windows Server 2012 when we scaled from just 16 nodes up to 64 nodes. You'd almost be in a continual state of patching. So we wanted to provide an automated solution, and we did this with cluster aware updating. Now, what cluster aware updating basically does is it will serially patch one node at a time. We basically go and provide a baseline, which is a collection of patches, go and scan all of the nodes in the cluster, figure out which of our nodes have the patch, which don't, and then serially go and patch them. Now, one of the underlying mechanisms that we use is also new in Windows Server 2012, and that is called node maintenance mode or node drain. So as I switch back to the demo here, I'm going to show you first a feature called prioritization, and then second, node drain. Now, what we have here with all of our different resources on the cluster, you can now see there's this new column called priority. And priority essentially gives us the ability to rank the importance of our different virtual machines. Now, why would you use this? Well, for example, when you want to start up your VMs, maybe you have critical infrastructure VMs, business applications, backend databases, you want those VMs to come online first. And so we're going to say those are high priority VMs. We then may have regular infrastructure VMs, medium, and then maybe some low priority VMs, you know, for some of our support organizations, for human resources, legal department, things like that. But every time we start up a cluster now, we're going to honor this prioritization setting, start our high, then our medium, then our low. But prioritization extends also in how we do maintenance on our cluster. Now, I mentioned that we have this new feature called maintenance mode. And so when we now pause a cluster, pause a node, which means nothing can come back onto it, we have the option of actually draining the roles as well, which basically means evacuate the node. So if I go ahead and I do this on my first node, what we're going to see is we're going to see no downtime to the VM, we're going to see this node pause, and then we're going to see our actual virtual machines serially live migrate. Now, another big enhancement we added in Windows Server 2012 was the ability to have simultaneous live migrations. By default, we set it up so that there's two live migrations that happen at once, but you can have as many live migrations as you want. Depending on how wide your bandwidth is, the quality of your network connections, you can simultaneously migrate 10 VMs, even 100 VMs. We have no limits that we impose. It's all based on your testing, your limitation. Now, as you can see on the screen, we have my high priority one is migrating first, then my medium, and once this first high priority is done, the other medium one will migrate. So we also honor this prioritization when we drain our nodes. Now, back to cluster aware updating, how this fits in. Cluster aware updating will actually call this function, drain nodes, when it actually performs the patching. And so what this means is, if you're patching a Hyper-V cluster, you pause a node, you drain it, those VMs are going to live migrate. So you can patch your entire physical infrastructure, live migrate all of the VMs with zero downtime to any of your applications, any of your services running inside those VMs. And this feature is now available in box with Windows Server Standard Edition and Windows Server Data Center Edition. And I'll clarify that one more time. Clustering and ClusterAware Updating are now available in Windows Server Standard Edition. In the past, it was only available in our premium editions. Now, one question that I know has already come up in the chat queue is, hey, Virtual Machine Manager has a cluster patching feature. Clustering has a cluster patching feature. What's the difference? When should I use which? Well, the way you want to separate this is Virtual Machine Manager's Cluster Update Manager. This can basically patch anything that Virtual Machine Manager manages. So this will go and patch your Hyper-V clusters. This will go patch your library servers, library clusters, your Pixie Boot servers, and basically any of these key infrastructure servers that Virtual Machine Manager is aware of. Now, what this means is Virtual Machine Manager, it doesn't go and manage SQL clusters. It doesn't go and manage file clusters, with the exception of the library. So it's not going to have the ability to go and patch every cluster in your environment. That's really the big distinction that we have with ClusterAware Updating. It supports any type of cluster running Windows Server 2012. So you can use ClusterAware Updating for your SQL clusters, for your file cluster, DHCP cluster, everything like that. So best logical separation, if VMM can manage it, patch it with that. For anything else that's a Windows Server 2012 cluster, use ClusterAware Updating. Now, one final distinction on which one to use as well. Virtual Machine Manager also manages down-level clusters. It manages our 2008 R2 clusters, and so we can use the Cluster Update Manager to patch those 2008 R2 clusters with VMM. Unfortunately, ClusterAware Updating only supports the Windows Server 2012 level. So if you have older clusters, you would want to go and use Virtual Machine Manager. Now, let's move over and briefly talk about Virtual Machine Manager. Have you seen any questions come up so far around VMM?
There's a number of questions about, I've seen a couple of questions about database, like does System Center, where does System Center store its own data? System Center has its own databases for example, Virtual Machine Manager has its own database.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me kind of add to that a little more. Now, with all the different System Center components, all of them have a requirement to be running SQL. SQL Server, and we will give you a free SQL license if you go and buy System Center, so you don't need to think about, hey, do I also need to get a SQL license? Don't worry about that. We'll take care of that. But really, our goal here is for these large enterprise management systems, there's a lot of data. Now, kind of one of the questions is, right, when do I go use Virtual Machine Manager compared to when do I just use Hyper-V? Well, Hyper-V Manager, you think, is managing on a single system. It's where you configure your networks, and you're managing just on that one box. Now, when you add failover clustering to it, we kind of scale up and we manage a collection of different hosts. And you can manage that from the single interface failover cluster manager. But what happens if you're managing dozens of hosts, hundreds of hosts, or even hundreds of clusters? This is really where you're going to start to want to think about using Virtual Machine Manager. This is where we manage at scale. This is where we're really trying to transform the environment, rather than just being a virtualized environment, over to a cloud environment. So, as we kind of think about what are Microsoft's key visions, key tenets towards the private cloud, we think about scale. Virtual Machine Manager supports 400 hosts, 8,000 VMs from a single management interface. Pooled resources. Virtual Machine Manager allows you to collect your storage infrastructure, network infrastructure, compute infrastructure, even different virtualization platforms, and manage it from a single location. So you can actually manage your VMware ESX infrastructure through Virtual Machine Manager. You can manage your Citrix Zen Center, Zen Server infrastructure through Virtual Machine Manager. So if you're managing a large infrastructure, this is when you want to really start about, why do I want to use Virtual Machine Manager? Where's this going to take place? Next major tenet of private cloud, automation. Virtual Machine Manager has a lot of great automated features from deployment, from bare metal, even just to distributing the resources and doing load balancing across the host so none of them are overwhelmed. So this is the big difference. When do we move from Hyper-V to VMM? When you need to scale up and start moving your infrastructure from highly virtualized to a dynamic, fluid, private cloud environment.
And speaking of scale, I'm not sure we actually mentioned this, so I thought I'd better quickly mention it. In terms of a Hyper-V cluster now, and in terms of how big our clusters can be now, we support up to 64 nodes and 8,000 virtual machines in a cluster. So we can support the largest clusters out there in the industry, and again, there's no better way to do it than to run System Center to manage it. One last thing I just wanted to kind of close on is, I just just wanted to be kind of very clear about something when it comes to how we think about our workloads and virtualization and management. When it comes to Microsoft workloads, whether it's Windows Server, whether it's Windows Client, whether it's Dynamics, SharePoint, Exchange, SQL, Link, let me be very clear about something. On a daily basis, just in the server organization, we create and test over 20 to 25,000 virtual machines and unit tests every single day. Not every week, not every month, not every quarter.
Every
day, okay? So that's just in the server organization. That's not counting what we're doing in terms of all of the other teams and all of the other technologies within Microsoft. But we're using Hyper-V literally everywhere. Azure is powered by Hyper-V, okay? Windows Server, Hyper-V. Windows Client has Hyper-V. If you're touching a Microsoft workload, if you're using any of our cloud workloads, any of our cloud capabilities, you're hitting Hyper-V every day. Every team at Microsoft is testing. We're doing performance tuning. We're doing deployments. We're doing automation. It's all on Hyper-V. So when it comes to what is our preferred hypervisor, let's be very clear. The best way to run Microsoft Dynamics, Microsoft Exchange, Microsoft SharePoint, Microsoft Link, Microsoft SQL Server is on Microsoft Hyper-V Server managed through Microsoft System Center, because those teams also build all the management packs that go into System Center to help us manage our workloads. And we know which counters we need to be monitoring, and which how to make sure that we're supporting the health model for a specific workload or application. So I know we're running out of time here, so I better pass it back to you, Simon.
Great answer. Well, we're going to switch back to the deck here. We're going to wrap up our live Q&A and the demos. And I want to point you to a lot of additional resources you have. So hopefully all of your questions have been answered by our great team of live Q&A helpers. Thank you, everybody, that's decided to help us out, help our customers out. We really appreciate that. But if you still have additional questions or think about something later, go to the TechNet forums, aka.ms/TechNet forums. There are literally dozens and dozens of different forums. Even within Hyper-V, it's broken down by storage, networking, clustered, and you can really ask any question you want, a lot of detail, and they're constantly monitored by our product team, by our MVPs, our most valuable professionals, to make sure that you can get quick, direct answers. So again, aka.ms/TechNet forums. For any in-person training events, if you want one of my fellow evangelists from around the world to go and actually give you in-person training, we're now running hundreds of what we call IT camps, which are hands-on in-person training events. So go to aka.ms/IT camps and check out the full list today. Don't forget that Microsoft Virtual Academy is a great free public online learning resource, and all of our trainings, Jeff and I did a jumpstart a few weeks ago, an 8-hour course breaking down all of these different areas we talked about today. Go to the MVA, go take that training, and then scale out to learn more about SQL Server, Link, all of the other different Windows Server and System Center components. And of course, don't forget Microsoft Learning content. There's a great class locator available at aks.ms/class locator, and a lot of Microsoft virtualization cloud courses, our mock exams, our official curriculum, as well as the full MCSC private cloud certification. And this is a great way to really validate and provide credentials to, you know, really have a good industry standard, something you can put on your resume to really qualify you as a Microsoft virtualization and cloud expert. With that, I want to thank you. I want to thank Jeff for joining me today. And I hope that you had a great time learning all about Microsoft virtualization, live Q&A. You got all your questions answered. And if for more, make sure you check out the Microsoft Virtual Academy. Jeff, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.